point, I just couldn't really cope with it. So about 4 or 5 weeks into it, you know, I was in Los Angeles with my mom and I was sitting with my dad. Decided to go to church, which is a good place to go on a Sunday. Decided to go to church. I went to this church, rather large church, maybe 800, 900 people in the service. Wanted to be anonymous, so I sat in back in the darker section of the sanctuary. And the service, you know, sort of went on, some singing, some sharing, preaching, all sort of, you know, I wasn't really into it. I wasn't really paying attention. And at the end of the sermon, they had a response song. And this song, I never heard the song before. And it sort of hit me like a ton of bricks. Sort of punched me in the gut, you know, I lost my breath. And it's just the words of the song just really resonated with me. And, you know, so I started crying. I'm not an emotional guy. I'm not trying to be defensive because I'm a male, but I'm just not an emotional guy. So I don't really cry. I had this wet stuff coming out down my face. You know, I didn't cry at my wedding. I didn't cry at my birth of my two children. But I cry when there's pain. So mostly at the dentist's office, okay, that's where I cry. And so I the song at the same moment sort of confused me, but spoke to me. So I want you to listen to this song. It's called Who Am I? I asked Christopher to perform it for us.
Of who I am, but because of what you've done, not because of what I've done, but because of who you are. I am a flower quickly fading, here today and gone tomorrow, a wave tossed in the ocean, a vapor in the wind, still you. Hear me when I'm calling, Lord, you catch me when I'm falling, and you told me who I am. I am yours. Who am I that the eyes that see my sin would look on me with love and watch me rise again? Who am I that the voice that calmed the seas would call out through the rain, calm the storm in me? Not because of who I am, but because of what you've done. Not because of what I've done, but because of who you are. I am a flower quickly fading, here today and gone tomorrow, a wave tossed in the ocean, a vapor in the wind, still you hear me when I'm calling, Lord, you catch me when I'm falling. And you told me who I am. I am yours. I am yours.
Have you ever had one of those God moments where God just speaks to you and no one else is in the room, although you're in a room with 1,000 other people, and it's like God speaking directly to me and only to me? And that's what it was like. And I think in that moment, it sort of made clear to me that my struggle was not with my father having a stroke and lying in bed. My struggle was with myself. And when I look back on it, it wasn't just that four-week period. It had been going on for months and months prior to that, actually, because I had defined who I was by what I did. So I'm a pastor, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a son, and what I had been doing was I was juggling all these balls up in the air, trying to keep them afloat. Right? I don't know if you've ever felt that way. You have all these different things going on, and you're trying to keep them from falling, and then when one of them falls, you try to catch it so it doesn't shatter on the floor, but I couldn't catch it. And then what happened was I started dropping all these other things. And so it was an internal thing with me. It wasn't an external thing with my father's stroke. It was more than that. I didn't know what to do because I didn't know who I was. And so quite possibly you may be in a somewhat similar mindset. Your life is sort of in turmoil. You're sort of trying to juggle all these things because they're all your identity. And if you drop one, then your whole life sort of shatters, and you already know that. Or possibly maybe you don't feel turmoil, but life is just sort of coasting along, but you're not coasting in any direction. You're just sort of going wherever the wind pushes you. In either case, you still have to ask the question, who am I? Who am I? Now, whether you've been a Christian for a long time or a short period, or maybe you're not even a follower of Jesus Christ yet, the power of the gospel gives clarity to who you are, because who Jesus Christ is. And so most of us try to add things to our lives to give our life significance, to give our lives meaning, to give ourselves an identity, but it never seems to get quite there. People need Jesus, because Jesus reminds us who we are. And the gospel transforms us into the created being that God wanted us to be when he first thought of us. Some people don't like the gospel. Some people say that the gospel is legalism. Well, legalism says that God will love us if we change. But that's not what the gospel is. The gospel says that God changes us because he loves us. And he wants to change us. He wants to transform us into the being, the person that he knows that we have to be. Otherwise, we'll never have a sense of identity and worth in this life. So I want to illustrate that this morning by sharing the story out of the Bible called The Woman at the Well from the Gospel of John. And it's maybe familiar to some of you. Let me just set it up really quickly. Jesus is teaching and preaching and healing people all over the area called Galilee. And he and his followers, his disciples, travel through an area called Samaria. Now, Samaria is populated by a people group called Samaritans. Samaritans and Jews don't really like each other. It goes way back into the Old Testament, where the nation of Israel was attacked and some of them were captured and carried away. And then when they had the chance to return to Jerusalem, to return to their own homeland, their own country, some of them chose to stay and intermarry with some of their captors. And so to a pure Jew, the Samaritans became half-Jews, half-breeds, impure. And so there was a little bit of tension, maybe a lot of tension, dividing them. So as they go through this area, they're tired, it's hot, they're hungry. The disciples say to Jesus, "We'll go find some food. You rest here, Jesus." And so the disciples go off into the town to find food, and Jesus is sitting at a well, and a Samaritan woman comes up to him. She's a little bit surprised because she's a woman, and she's alone in this area with a man. On top of that, he's a Jew, and she's a Samaritan. Jews and Samaritans keep their social distance from each other. They do not interact with one another usually. So Jesus asks her for a drink. So, "May I have a drink?" And they get into this conversation about water, and Jesus moves the conversation towards living water. Now, the woman thinks that Jesus is talking about this infinite water supply, where she will not have to go and bring her bucket to the well and carry it back to her home. She doesn't have to do any of that. So it's an infinite water supply. And Jesus is not really talking about that. In verse 4:15, the woman says to Jesus, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus is talking about one thing. He's moved the conversation on, and she's still thinking about physical water. Then Jesus tells her, in a really odd sort of turn of conversation, to go get her husband. In verse 16, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered Jesus, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." So in her past, Jesus draws this out because he knows. He says, "You have had five husbands, and the man you're living with now is not your husband." So from verse 18, in this single verse, and you've probably heard this over and over again when you've heard this passage preached, from the single verse of verse 18, we have branded this woman a sinner. We have branded her some kind of harlot because she's with a man. She's already had five husbands. But the problem is there's nothing in this passage that indicates that she's a sinner. Now stay with me for a second. See, so John, who wrote the passage, the Apostle John, who wrote the book, and Jesus, neither of them indicate that the woman's a sinner, that she's committed some kind of sin. Jesus never says, "Oh, woman, you need to repent." Never says that in this passage. Jesus actually never even speaks of sin in this passage. Now, so we have to understand a little bit about the background here, because she could have easily been widowed or divorced or abandoned. Now, five times to have lost a husband in some way is heartbreaking, absolutely, but not impossible. There are a number of different ways you can think about this. So, for example, in that culture, women, teenage girls, got married very early, around the age of 15 or so. Now, in today's day, we think of, Romeo and Juliet, two teenagers getting married and living happily ever after. It didn't work that way in those days. Two teenagers would not get married because a teenage boy has no way to support a family. So the teenage girl would be married to an older man, and that she would become his wife. Now, if you think about that scenario, then, they both get older and older. The man eventually dies and leaves the younger woman alone. A woman who's been married before cannot survive in that society. She has to get married again. So this could have happened multiple times. So it's not an impossibility. Also, in biblical times, unlikely a woman would ask the husband for a divorce. Usually it doesn't happen. Usually it's the man that could demand a divorce, and that would automatically happen. But what about this thing about living with a man? You're living with someone now who's not your husband. Again, she could be living with someone that she was dependent on. In biblical times, there's something called a levirate marriage, in which a woman who's married to a man, and the husband dies. Well, to not abandon her, the deceased husband's brother would take this woman on as his wife so that she could have children and heirs to the family. Sometimes she was not technically called his wife, and he was not technically called her husband, but they were together. And so this was just a way to help the woman continue on with the family line. So it's not out of the realm of imagination to think that no sin has occurred here. The difficulty with the interpretation that she's a sinner is it doesn't hold up with the rest of the passage, and it trips up the rest of the story. So immediately after Jesus describes her past, she says in verse 19, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. our fathers worshiped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is a place where people ought to worship. Now, if you believe the worst of her, that she's some kind of sinner, then this is some clumsy way of trying to change the topic, right? And that she just doesn't want to talk about it. But if you can believe that there's another scenario where her life is more just tragic versus intentional, then it looks a little bit different. The idea of perceiving or seeing in the book of John is connected with believing or having faith of some sort. So when the woman says, I perceive that you're a prophet, I see that you're a prophet, she's making some kind of belief statement that Jesus is at least from God and that he has a prophetic nature about him. She didn't say anything about her background, yet Jesus tells her everything about her previous husband and the situation she's in right now. Why does she ask, where should we worship? You know, you worship over there, we worship over here. Why does she even bring that up? And I think it's because when she realizes she's in the presence of a prophet, someone who can perceive everything about her, but also is spoken to by God, she wants to ask the central question which has divided her, the Samaritans, from the Jews for centuries and centuries. This whole single issue has divided them ever since the days of the Old Testament. Again, it's not an awkward dodge or an academic diversion that she's trying to perpetrate here. It's a question that goes to what separates her as a Samaritan from believing in a Jewish Messiah. She wants to know. So Jesus responds this way in verse 21. He said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews." And with a simple statement, what Jesus does here, he says, you know, it's not about a battle for space. It's not about ownership over land. It has nothing to do with that. Nothing, absolutely. It's not going to be on that mountain or in this city. He goes on to say in verse 23, "But the hour is coming and is here now when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." Jesus says, let's not talk about a place, because a place doesn't matter. What matters is people. And more than that, what type of people is God looking for? The question of identity is no longer about, oh, you're a Jew and you're a Samaritan, we don't get along, how can we resolve this? It's about, who is God looking for? God is looking for worshipers, for people who will find their true identity and the true value and the true worth in worshiping in spirit and truth of the true God. That's who God is looking for. Her response in verse 25 is this. She says to Jesus, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called the Christ." And she has this acknowledgement that there will be some kind of Messiah coming. "And when he comes, he will tell us everything. He will tell us all things." And Jesus responds to her, "I who speak to you am he." And it's boom, she has this light bulb go off in her head. And her world comes to this crystal clarity about who Jesus is, but what his life has been all about. And she realizes she's not only talking to some Jewish man, a stranger, she's been talking to a prophet, not only a prophet, but the Messiah. And she goes back to her village to tell all her neighbors about Jesus, the man who is the Messiah. Her marital history does not make her a sinner. The story is not about sin. The story is about the power of the gospel, the power of the gospel. And as much as the woman has seen Jesus, has seen him for a prophet and now as the Messiah, Jesus has also seen her. Jesus has seen her problems. Jesus has seen her plight. He has seen her situation, recognized her, spoken to her, and offered her something of infinite worth. Jesus has seen her and tells her that God's calling true worshipers. That's the bottom line. That's the most important thing for her to know. This is what she was meant to be. This is why she exists. And she has worth and value and significance only and that she worships the true God. So in 22 verses or so, John's story moves from the subject of racism between Jews and Samaritans to a question over national and religious identity. You worship there, we worship here. And it ends with a woman's village, the entire village, believing that Jesus is the Messiah. It's a great story. For many of us, though, we can't see ourselves in this story. And we can't see ourselves relating to this woman because we have branded her this horrible sinner. It's like, I'm not like that woman. I would never be like that woman. It's a great story. It has nothing to do with me. But she is just living unexpected and unfortunate circumstances. And many of us experience the same thing. We can all relate to that. That in spite of our circumstances, we, like the woman, are just trying to make life work, right? It's like life could always be better. And sometimes it's really bad for some people. And we're just trying to make life work. Sometimes life becomes a mess. Now, for most of you, I would suspect that your circumstances, that your trying circumstances, your difficult circumstances, have nothing to do with anything that you've done. That they just sort of came upon you. Just like the woman in our story. Her husband's dying. She had nothing to do with that. It just came upon her. So maybe, you know, some of you in this room are widowed. You've lost your husband or your wife, and you're dealing with that. Or some of you are going through financial difficulty with job situations, or you know, not having enough to cover bills. Some of you have difficult family members. You just can't imagine going into a home and living under the same roof with this father and this mother or this sibling because it's so horrible in your household. And those are just the circumstances and situations that have been put upon you that you have no control over. So you see, when you suffer, and sometimes some of us or most of us suffer silently, there's nothing like a little bit of suffering to remind us that we are not in control very much. Or suffering to remind us of how little power we actually have over our own lives. It doesn't take much suffering and much difficulty in life to remind us of those things. When those things arise, when those situations arise, we can easily lose our way, lose sight of who we are. We forget everything and life becomes all about us and these balls that we're trying to juggle and this life we're trying to live in spite of our circumstances. You know what you don't need? You don't need some pithy Christian saying to help you get through the day. You don't need some saying that says, oh, you know, just think about what Jesus would do and do the same thing. WWJD, come on. You know, you don't need that. You don't need some false promise of, I'll pray for you. And you know the person's not really going to pray for you. What you need is a God that meets you where you are. Is a God that enters into your life and exposes those places where you have covered up with a calloused sort of mentality and let God expose those things. Again, sin has marred those image, but the gospel shows us who we are because of who Jesus is. Not by any power or control of ourselves. And this is why people need Jesus. And you think that, well, you know, where do I find this Jesus? And where do I go so that Jesus can speak directly into my life? Where do I go that, you know, I just want for Jesus to transform me? Now, some of you have come here this morning because you think, well, I should go to church because God's at church, right? I'm gonna meet Jesus at church. You know, I think it's great that, you know, you have that sort of idea. But Jesus is everywhere. If you believe in the character of Jesus, Jesus is everywhere. And so Jesus has already met you, actually. Jesus has already met you at your home, at your workplace, in your car. And he has called you here. You just have to say, Who are you, Jesus, and who am I? That song that Christopher sang for us is called Who Am I? And the response to that song is, I am yours. That the singer says, I am yours, God. I am yours. The chorus reads, not because of who I am, but because of what you've done. Not because of what I've done, but because of who you are. And I think it's just a great reminder that life, it's not about what we can do or what we can manufacture. How can we get out of our own problems? But it's really about what God has already done to us and in us and through us because of the gospel and the power of the gospel. As we observe communion this morning, I want you to think about all these ways you've been trying to make life work for yourself. You know, for some of you, maybe you're like me, you're just juggling balls around. For some of you, you're just letting life sort of coast and you're getting pushed left and pushed right. How do you want Jesus to speak to you? And just ask him. And just tell him. Here we take communion. We're going to ask you to come up and we'll take the cup and the bread back to your seat. If you're a baptized believer in our church or a church of similar faith, I encourage you strongly to participate in communion. Because we walk up, would you clear the seats and the aisles in front of you so no one trips? I just want to leave you with this thought, though. Someone said this once, and I'll put it up on the screen, that Christianity is not first and foremost about our behavior, our obedience, our response, and our daily victory over sin. It's first and foremost about Jesus. It is resurrection, ascension, and promised return. He goes on to say, we are justified and sanctified by grace alone, through faith alone, in the finished work of Christ alone. Even now, the banner on which Christians live reads, it is finished. Everything we need and everything we look for in things smaller than Jesus is already ours in Christ. Let me leave that up on the screen for a little bit while you meditate, prepare your hearts for communion.